obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly. And I am a grateful member of Al-Anon. What a great topic for this meeting. I don't have to be alone anymore. And I was just sitting there and listening to the readings. What a wonderful reading. And looking out at everybody. And there are familiar faces here today and unfamiliar faces here today. And I love that because for today, we're all drawn here for the same reason, for recovery and for a dose of happiness. And the party starts now. And I'm just so grateful that I was invited to participate because I have spent way too much of my life not participating in things unless somebody grabbed me by the hand and dragged me. And Al-Anon's great at that. Come along. Here's where the party is. So I'm glad that you dragged me to the party today and that I get to participate. I was feeling pretty alone this morning because I had certain ideas of how today was going to be. My kids went to school, and in my mind, my husband was going to get away from work, and we were going to have lunch together, and so I could, you know, say goodbye, and I love you, and enjoy your adventure, I'll enjoy mine, and he wasn't able to take off of work. And so I was packing, and I was feeling a little bit alone, right? This is what we do. I had expectations, didn't realize I had them. And then I thought, well, I'll just turn on some music. I turned on some music, started to enjoy it, started to turn it up a little bit louder, started packing, thinking about the luncheon, thinking about the banquet, thinking about who am I going to run into, who am I going to see, what miracles are going to happen here, for whom, for me, for you, for newcomers, what late night marathon am I going to go to where the real magic is going to happen. And all of a sudden, I wasn't alone anymore. I didn't know who you were. But I felt connected. I felt connected. And that's what the program of Al-Anon has given me, is a way to be 100% significantly connected to joy, whether I have him, her, it in my life or not. And what a relief that is. What a freedom. I was so nervous. I'm nervous now. My knees are shaking. I could barely breathe. And I always know, I think I picked this up in Al-Anon, and I think somebody said this to me, if you're nervous, then a miracle is about to happen. If you're afraid, then that's right where you're supposed to be in this program. And so I know that for today, this is where I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to walk through fear and get to the joy that my higher power has waiting on the other side. to tell you a little bit about my life, I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad was a drinker and a rager, and he was the kind of drinker who would disappear for long bouts of time, and he would drink and be gone, and none of us would talk about him not being there. We would set the dishes for him every night. We wouldn't look at the empty plate. We'd clean it up. We'd put it there the next night. We'd wonder where he is, but nobody would talk about it. And we would all feel this loneliness and this angst and this pain about his absence. Then when he would come home, it would be worse, right? He would come home and everything would seem fine and we'd be walking on eggshells, and then before you knew it, and usually it happened at the dinner table because we always had dinner together, no matter what, always. And inevitably at some point through the conversation, dishes would go flying and anger would start and everybody would be scratching their heads trying to figure out what was it this time. And the best way I could describe growing up in an alcoholic home is that I felt a little bit like Alice in Wonderland who fell down the rabbit hole. Now looking back, I realize I feel like just my life was strange, grotesque things that were oversized and running around, and mom was like the white hare, gotta be this, gotta do that, checking up on him, doing this, doing that. And there were Tweedledee and Tweedledum, right? And there was the caterpillar, who are you? And I didn't know, right? And everything was just I mean, and I was like Alice, just kind of doe-eyed and just, where do I go? What do I do? Do I go this way? Do I do that? And when I couldn't get answers in the home, then I would study people at school, other grown-ups, teachers. I would watch and watch and watch and try to figure out how everybody else was making decisions, how everybody else knew how to do things. I always felt like maybe God in the beginning of time had this meeting where he explained the whole how to live thing, how to do school, how to do this, and I was at the bathroom. I missed that. And I always felt like I was, everybody else knew what they were doing, and I didn't. And I know that I had to figure it out, and I needed you to not know how clueless I was. And I could still have that feeling come up sometimes. The only difference is that now with my program, I realize that that's called being human. Everybody feels that way, right? So for me, what I've learned in Al-Anon, I always sum it up to one phrase, which is, welcome to the human race. You guys taught me it wasn't that I was insignificant or I was doing something wrong. I was just human. And Al-Anon has taught me the difference between character flaws and just being human. And I could be much more loving with myself today. But as a child, I didn't know that. I had an older brother who was quite a star in our family. He was an athlete and a star athlete. He was written up in the paper. And any money we had went to buying his equipment and financing all of his adventures. And my brother was an exploder, and which is why he was such a great athlete. He took all of that rage and got it out in sports. I was a burrower, and I just burrowed deep inside. And I was quiet, and I was a goody two-shoes. I got A's and B's in school. My parents' friends would come over and say, oh, you're so sophisticated for your age. You're so mature for your age. What they didn't know was that inside I was screaming, one obscenity after another. But I was so afraid of letting that out, so incredibly afraid of letting that out. And so when I was in seventh grade, I was in school one day, and I was feeling, I kind of hit a bottom. I was tired of feeling insignificant. I was tired of feeling unwanted, unloved, and alone. And so that day when I went to school, I decided that I was going to take my life that day. And I had the previous day gone down to the teacher's lounge and looked in the teacher's lounge, and they had knives in there. And so, you know, it was kind of a half-baked plan. I was just going to pick up a knife and stab myself in the heart. Not very creative, I see now looking back. However, that was my plan. And so that day I raised my hand and I asked the teacher if I could go to the health office, and she said I could. And I walked down to the teacher's lounge, and when I walked in that day, all of the utensils were gone. Everything was gone. And, you know, in my step work and working with my sponsor, and what I learned from you is that I had a higher power before I ever knew I had a higher power. And I can look back now and see that as a moment where my higher power was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And what I have learned here is that when God has a plan for me, nothing I can do can screw that up. Nothing. I haven't always had the best of motives or the best of plans. And sometimes I've been an impetuous child and done the wrong thing, and God doesn't let me get away with it because he has a miracle for me. And that day he was saying, no, I have more in store for you. That's not how I viewed it at the time. How I viewed it at the time was that God was making fun of me just like everybody else, and that I was a failure in this too. I couldn't even do this right. And I ran to the bathroom and I cried. And I cried and cried and cried. And this girl came down from my classroom that day. And when I heard the door open, I lifted my feet up and she said, Kelly, I know you're in here. And I was quiet as long as I could. And she said, I know you're in here. Come out. And I came out. And that was the first time I was ever honest with another living soul about anything. I didn't tell her everything, but I told her that I was going to take my life, that I wanted to just not be here anymore. And we weren't friends. We didn't know each other very well. And I said, why did you come down here? And she said, I just got this feeling that I needed to come check on you. Wow. Again, my higher power looking out for me that day. So I went home that day and I told my mom. My mom had been in Al-Anon. I was the last person in my family to get recovery. My mom went to Al-Anon first. My dad went to AA second. My older brother went to Alateen for a little while and then decided it wasn't for him. This day I came home and told my mom, well, I almost killed myself today. And she said, I think it's time to go to Alateen. And I told her, I can't go. I cannot do that. And she said, why can't you? And I think because that girl had come into the bathroom and I got some practice being honest, I could be honest with my mom. And also, the reason why I could be honest with my mom is because our dynamic was changing. Because she was going to Al-Anon, she was no longer that crazy, rigid person that we come into Al-Anon being. She could pause and she could listen. And that was new. And so when she said, what happened today, she was listening. And man, that's all I wanted. That's all I wanted. And so I told her, I don't think I could go. There's no way I could walk into a room full of teenagers by myself. There's no way. And she said, well, what can I do to make it easier? Because you are going to go. And I'm so grateful because I'm so grateful to my mother that she did not give me a choice to go to Al-Anon. I fought her. I called her names every car ride to every meeting for I don't even know how many months. And she suffered. I remember looking at her and telling her, I hate your guts. How can you take me to this meeting? I hate your guts. And she had tears. She had tears. She would smoke her cigarette and she had tears. And the reason why I'm crying now is because I know what she was doing is she was connected to you. And so in that moment where the daughter that she cherished was yelling at her, she was holding on to your miracles that she heard in the meetings, and she was putting it into practice. And she turned to me on one of those occasions driving to the meeting, and she said, that's okay. You can hate me. And that stopped me in my tracks. And I said, well, what do you mean I can hate you? And she said, I'm your mother and I love you. And I care for your recovery. And if you need to hate me for me to help you, then that's the way it's going to be. So the way she got me to go was, she was very clever. She asked an Al-Anon friend who had a son if they wouldn't mind coming to the house and we would drive together. And so when that doorbell rang that first time for my first Alateen meeting and this other woman answered the door, she had this very attractive son. And all of a sudden my attitude changed. I still remember his name. His name was Brady. I have no idea where he is. But, you know, when I saw Brady, all of a sudden, no problem. I have no problem going to Alateen. And I started going to meetings for Brady just to see him. And I'm so glad that we don't have to have the right motives to get in the doors of Al-Anon and Alateen, because I didn't have the right motives for quite some time. But by the time I did have the right motives, everything that people were sharing in the meeting was sinking in. I was like a sponge, and I didn't realize it. I thought I was resisting it all because I thought I had this wall up, but it was trickling in. And so even though I went to see Brady for the longest time, you know, eventually he stopped going, and I kept going. And I'm so glad that I did. Here are some things that I learned in Alateen that changed my life. We don't talk about the alcoholic here. And the way I learned that, you know, Alateens are blunt. And I remember when I finally had enough nerve to raise my hand and share. It took a long time for me to raise my hand and share in a meeting. And when I did, I started talking about my dad. And it was like, finally, the top flew off and I could just let it all out. And that's what I was doing. And he this and he that. And Alateen interrupted and said, I'm really sorry, Kelly. We're happy that you are sharing, but we don't share about the alcoholic here. When you're ready to share about yourself, you can share. I don't know if that would happen in a meeting now, but that happened then. I was so humiliated that I stormed out of that meeting. I remember it was at a hospital, and I was walking down the street, and I was 14 years old, and I lit a cigarette, and I started smoking that cigarette, and then I sat down on this planter, and I was angry, and I thought, how could they say that to me, right? Because I was still a victim. It was all about me, and I was everybody's victim. And when I sat down, I was angry, and I was playing with the flowers in the planter, and there were all these weeds, and before I knew it, all of those weeds were moved away, and there was a tiny little rosebud. And that was the first time that I actually heard my higher power. See, because it was trickling in. Even though I didn't know I believed in a higher power yet, I knew you did, and the magic was happening. And when I saw that little rosebud, I thought, this awareness came to me that my life right now is just like there's a rose in there somewhere, and it's just covered with all of these weeds. And that those people in those meetings are going to help me clear away those weeds. And I felt it. I felt it. And it was the first time I was able to put my tail back between my legs and walk in humbly and sit down and listen and know that I belonged. The other thing that I learned there was that I got tricked into loving alcoholics there. Because I hated all alcoholics. They were evil. And I shared this in a meeting, and my Alateen sponsor came up to me afterwards. And this was a man that I was hugging on a weekly basis. I loved that man. I loved that Alateen sponsor. And he put his arms around me after the meeting. He says, wow, you really hate alcoholics. And I said, well, of course I do. And he said, you know, I'm an alcoholic. What? You tricked me? And I cried. And I said, but I love you. You're here for me every week. And he said, do you think you could go home and give that hug to your dad that you give to me? And I said, I'll try. I'll try. And that was when I started giving my dad a hug. My dad had been sober for 3 years, and I hadn't been hugging him. And I went home and started hugging him. And this beautiful thing started to happen in our family. My dad was working his program, my mom was working her program, and now I'm working my program. And we're having conversations at the table about what we're learning in our program and what our sponsors are telling us. And anytime one of us, you know, is sharing something, some crisis, we'll say, go call your sponsor. Or, you know, we'll direct each other to, I'm not your solution, go find it. And you know, it's such a wonderful thing because we thought we were each other's solution for so long. And this is a selfish program. And my mother is my biggest hero in my life. She was the trailblazer. She went to Al-Anon and suffered everybody's hatred one at a time. And eventually, every family member found the rooms that they needed to find. And my mom's no longer with me today. I mean, she's here. I know she's here. But she's no longer here. And look at the gift that she's given me for my whole life. For my whole life. So in Alateen, I got to go to bashes and campouts, and that's when I started to live in the moment. I didn't have a childhood until 14. At 14, it started. And I'm still a kid. I'm not willing to give that up. But it started at 14, and I got to be a part of, I got to participate, I got to love, I got to laugh. And I also got to experience what it was like to fall in love with him and be obsessed with him. And what happened was when I was 14, I went to a conference, and he walked in, and I remember like it was yesterday. I was still a wallflower. I was totally quiet. I was still a burrower, and I was in the room, and he walked in with his shirt off, a mohawk, two missing teeth, and he said, hi, I'm so-and-so, and you can all F off. And I thought, that's what I want to be. I know that sounds strange, but for a person who felt so like she couldn't let anybody know, to have somebody who just owned it and just proclaimed it. And the strange thing about him is that to this day, people love him for that. I mean, I mean, anybody who knows him, and a few of you do, know that. And I understand now why I was so attracted to him, because I wanted what he had. I wanted that. And so our relationship began. And before that point, I had never known what it was like to be obsessed with another individual. And that relationship was on and off and on and off for the next 6.5 years of my life. Actually, 7, from 14 until I was 21. And I learned in that relationship what it was like to make threats that you think you're going to carry out and then you never do, right? Because I can't call him anything, because he doesn't call himself that, but I can say that his drinking and drugging bothered me. And I can tell you that many times I told him that if I catch you doing this again, we're done, and we'd be done. And then, you know, the pleading and the I'm so sorry and I will never do it again. And, you know, I only did it because, you know, and I would just, oh, yeah, I can see that. Right? And it was high highs and low lows. And the thing about loving somebody, loving a person in that situation, is that, man, those highs are highs. He made me feel like I was the center of the universe. And for somebody who felt like nothing, I mean, it couldn't get any better than that. I know that he was my drug. He was my drug, because when I was with him, nothing touched me. There was not a care in the world. And when I would be away from him in those moments where we would break up, all of a sudden things would be hard again. Things would get really hard. And I'd find myself picking up that phone and calling him, and we'd be back together like that. And it was just like denial city, right? As long as we could lead that wave of just happy high, we would. And the lows were low. Right? The lows were low. We would get back together every time, and the last time that we got back together, see, every time I would get back together with him, I would feel ashamed. I don't know if you know what I mean, but we would get back together, and I'd find myself, kind of how I've always thought of an alcoholic taking that drink, after getting off the phone or getting back together, I'd think, how did I get here again? How did I get here again? Why did I let him back in again? Because the high would not last as long every time. And so I finally, the last time, decided, we got back together, and I felt that shame within 15 minutes after getting off the phone, and I called him right back and said, I can't do this anymore. And I think my higher power gave me the courage and the wherewithal, and this was because of the program. See, what happened was, you gave me self-esteem through the steps, through the traditions. All of a sudden, I started to dream. And I started to dream of the life that I wanted. I started to dream about a relationship. What kind of a relationship that I wanted? If he could be everything I wanted, he would be this, that, and the other. And so I learned that I needed to let go, that I'm the one who's responsible for my happiness. And so I finally got to the point without relationship where I said, enough is enough. I will cut off my hand before I will go back to that individual. And that's how I felt. Enough is enough. It was like my bottom with him. And in the beginning, it was very hard. It was very difficult. However, because of all of the work that was going on with my sponsor, I worked at a coffee shop at the time, and I was working at this coffee shop, and this guy works into the coffee shop, and he orders a coffee, and he makes a joke, and it makes me laugh, and he walks out. And this is the person who eventually becomes my husband. I have to tell you that when I first saw him, I did not notice him at all. He wasn't that alcoholic razzle-dazzle, you know, you feel the waves of that body walk through a room. Not that at all, right? He was a person who wouldn't have been even on my radar. He ordered a coffee, he made a joke, it made me laugh, he walked out. He would come every day for coffee, and I would take a break, and we would talk. And when we would talk, we had the same interests. and he was intelligent, and he was funny. And slowly but surely, when he wasn't there, I would think, oh, that guy didn't come in. And I'd be kind of bummed out about it. And my friends who worked with me said, oh, you like that guy? And I'd say, oh, no, I don't like that guy. And you like that guy? See, because I didn't know what love looked like. In the home I grew up in, my mom and my dad did love each other, but it got lost in translation. It got lost in translation of the alcoholic chaos in the house. So I didn't see examples of intimacy or trust for a long time. My husband one day left a note on my car, and the only way we were interacting was him coming to the coffee shop, and he left this note on my car this one day that said, if you're not busy after work, feel free to stop by, and it was a map to his house. And I saw this, and my coworker, John, says, oh, you're going to go to his house, right? And I said, of course not. I am not going to his house. I am not going to give that message. What kind of a message would I be sending if some guy says, come to my house, and I just rush right there? And he says, Kelly, this is like the nicest guy on the planet. I'm sure you're going to be safe. Go, 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 or you're going to lose him. Just go. And I was scared, and I was shaking, and I drove over to his house. And on this map to his house, there was a treasure chest drawn on there. And so in the course of being at his house for a little while, I said, I have to ask you, what is this treasure chest that's on your map? And he said, that's where you work. And he blushed. Oh. He's a nice guy. He's a nice guy. And I started to get butterflies in my stomach every time I saw him. Because what was happening was my mind and my soul was becoming attracted to this person. And he started to become physically attractive. It came from the inside out. All my relationships prior to that started with something from the outside. They were so magnetic and they were so attractive. And then slowly over time, they became more unattractive and more unattractive and more unattractive. And this worked the other way. And I can honestly tell you that I have been married to this man for 17 years. And he's not in program. He comes from a normal family, which I think is one of the biggest successes of my life, I have to say. Because I could not go for a normal guy for so... I firmly believe that my higher power knew that I needed to start working a program as early as 14 in order to be ready to meet my husband. I really believe that. Had I not experienced this other relationship, I would not have been ready. And even then, when he and I met, the first time we kissed, I ran. See, because I'm a runner. That's what I've learned in my step work. I didn't have to realize that in that other relationship because I felt superior to. Because he was the one who was cheating. He was the one who was getting high. He was the one who this, that, and the other. And I was Miss Holy High Horse on a mountain judging. And I didn't know that until I was in a relationship with a nice guy. And as soon as we kissed, I ran into the arms of somebody else. And I was at the San Fernando Valley AA convention. And my sponsor was there. I arrived on a Friday night, and I bumped into her, and we sat down, and she started talking to me about that guy, and meaning my current husband. And I said, let me tell you about this new guy I'm dating. And she kept interrupting and saying, oh, this is the one who's your friend, right? Oh, this is the one. No. Long story. There's another guy. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And she'd say, oh, but is he your friend, dear? Is he your friend? And I don't know how many times she said it. Maybe the 14th time I heard it. And I got that sinking feeling. Kelly, you've made the biggest mistake of your life. And it's like the clarity of my running, my fear, my relationship issues, they all hinged on her comment. And this was before cell phones. And I said, I have to go. She said, you just got here. The convention just started. I said, I have to go. I have to go back to Orange County. I'll explain it to you later. And I got in my car and I drove all the way from the San Fernando Valley to Fullerton, California. And it was a Friday night. And I said, I'm going to call him. And I'm talking to my higher power in the car out loud. I'm going to call him and I'm going to tell him everything. I'm like, really, like in a meeting. I don't know if he can handle it, but I'm going to tell him all of it. And if he's home, great. And if he's not home, it's not meant to be. And I am just, I feel that desperation of righting this wrong. And when I got to my apartment, I called him. Can I come over? Yes, you can. I get to his house and he won't let me in. He says, we're going to talk out here. And he's got that wall up. And he said, what's up? And I said, oh my gosh, I have to tell you, I just discovered. I don't know how to do relationships, blah, blah, blah. And I told him everything. It was like a fourth step. I told him about my relationship. Here's what it was like. Here's the role I played. Here's the role he played. I thought I was better then. I only know how to do that. I don't know how to be equals. When you look at me, it scares the heck out of me because, like, you see my soul. Makes me want to run and hide under a rock. I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to kiss a person who I know is going to maybe kiss only me for the rest of my life, who loves me. I don't know how to do that. And I said, I'm so sorry. And it was my first time feeling like that awful person who hurt somebody else because I couldn't be grown up enough. And I said, I'd like to try again, please, but I can't make any promises. I can't promise you I'm not going to screw it up. This scares the heck out of me. And he was quiet for a while, and he said, if it was anybody other than you, I'd say, get the heck out of here. I'll give you one more chance. The rest is history. And with the courage of you and my sponsor, I got to work with my sponsor very meticulously on how to suit up and show up for a nice guy and how to do this thing called commitment. And how to change old ideas of what you think a relationship's supposed to be and what you think love is supposed to feel like. To tell you more about that relationship and my higher power's gifts, when we were married in 1997, and in 2006, my mom passed away. And she had a heart attack. I didn't get to say goodbye. It was sudden. And my husband was so sweet. I got the call, and he could tell by the look on my face, and he immediately got into action without me saying anything. He made a travel mug of coffee and said, I love you, and he kissed me on the head, and he said, go. And I got in the car, and I drove to the hospital, and my mom was on life support for a week until all of us family members could figure out how to say goodbye. And, you know, when my mom passed away, this program became very hard for me. And I remember going to my home group, and the ladies there would put their arms around me and say, how are you doing? How are you doing? They knew my mom, and they knew me since I was 14. And I looked at one member, and during the break, I said, what do you do when sitting in a meeting hurts worse? Because since 14 years old, I've been doing this thing as a family thing. And she said, oh, honey, I don't know. And she cried with me. And it was so comforting to hear her say, I don't know. Because I knew. I knew nobody knew. So I hadn't heard anybody share it. And she said, if you have to go, go. We'll keep a seat warm for you. If you can stay, stay. We love you. And I was on a committee. I had a commitment. And I walked into that convention on Friday, and the bottom dropped out, and I felt like, I can't do this right now. And I talked to the chair and said, I can't do this. And he said, I understand. I love you. And I went home. And right on the heels of that, I got pregnant with my second child. And my husband and I thought, you know how we do this thing where something happens in our life and we think, oh yeah, we know what this means. This, and when I got pregnant after my mom passed, I thought, oh, this is going to be the up. This is going to be the upswing, right? This is going to be the joy. We got pregnant. This is going to help. So I got pregnant, had my baby, and at 3 months of age, she started to have seizures. And she started to have between 100 and 200 seizures a day. And there was nothing we could do. And we took her to Chalk Hospital, and we got her diagnosis. And we found out that she has this extremely rare form of epilepsy that they don't have any answers for. And the doctor sat my husband and I down and said what her prognosis was. And he told us she will most likely never walk, she'll never talk, and she'll never know you're her parents. And the best thing you can do is institutionalize her. And it was at this time, it's not the same, I realize it's different, but it's at this time that my journey began in Al-Anon of knowing what it was like to watch your child decline. And I'm sure it's different when your child is drinking than having seizures, but when people share about their children who are alcoholics and how hard it is to watch them decline and not be able to do anything about it, it touches a nerve for me. And I think of little Charlotte. So the doctor tells us our prognosis, and then you guys were with me in that hospital because I said, okay, that's the textbook, that's the clinical, now tell me, do you have any miracle stories? Let's get to it. What are the miracle stories? And he said, there are a few, but we don't understand them, and I wouldn't count on it happening. And he said, basically, we don't have a medicine that works. We combine a whole bunch of them like a cocktail, and we just hope that, and it won't work, and we'll keep messing with it and messing with it and messing with it. And we said, okay, let's start. And we had to make a lot of difficult decisions. And I got to know the feeling of having to make decisions of life and death and having to just hold on to my higher power's hand and let go of the results. Because I didn't know if the decisions I was making were going to heal her or kill her. The medicines that they were telling us we had to use were that strong. And so my husband and I would have a group conscience. We took the traditions. We worked the traditions in our family, and we would take a group conscience, and we would come together, and we would decide together. And it began this long journey of making decisions. She had seizures for 2 years. And after one of her treatments, her seizures stopped. And today she hasn't had a seizure for like 5 years. And what happened when she had those seizures is she stopped developing. And since her seizures have stopped, and since she has been weaned off her medication, she has started to develop again. Now, I don't know where this will lead. As far as our journey together, I cannot project. Because if I project, I have her needing me to look over her shoulder and help her with everything for the rest of her life. If I project, I see people taking advantage of her. If I project, I see all of those things. And so now I understand once again, I'm grateful I grew up in an alcoholic family. My daughter, Charlotte, was given to me very intentionally. I know that because of you. And I, once again, going back, I needed every meeting, every step, every tradition, every crisis, every chaos, every single thing to get me where I needed to be that mom of Charlotte. And I will tell you that I have had a spiritual experience with Charlotte, and that is, there was one time when I was in meditation with my higher power, and I was in so much pain, and I was crying, and I was praying, and I said, because, you know, I keep it real with my higher power. That's how I pray. I just kind of, you know, God, And I'll even swear. Because, you know, he doesn't judge me. He loves me unconditionally, right? That's what you've told me. So I'll just be me. And I was crying, and I said, God, if you could just tell me, if you could just tell me that she's going to be okay. I don't even care how far in the future it is. If it's 50 years from now, if you could just tell me she's going to be okay, then I could go through hell and high water. And then I kind of giggled to myself and said, but I know it doesn't work that way. And so I will continue to get on my knees and let go every day. And right on the heels of that, I had this, I don't even know the word for it. I had this vision where I was sitting in this chair and I was holding Charlotte in my arms. And there was this light behind me, my higher power behind me. And every time I went to look at this light, I couldn't see, but I knew there was light, and I saw these arms just.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Scoop little Charlotte out of my arms and draw her to it. Him, her, it, whatever it was. And at that point, I could look. And what I saw was this love and connection and just like I love my children more than I love anything on this planet. And I can tell you what I saw in that love between that child and my higher power, or my child's higher power, was like my love 1,000-fold. And then I looked over my left shoulder and I saw my mom. And I don't have visions. And you could tell me I'm crazy. Maybe I am. I don't have visions. The only one I ever had of my mom. And my mom was behind me. And she just was beautiful. And she was smiling. That Al-Anon smile. You know, like real joy. Like joy, joy. And I said, oh, mom, is she going to be okay? And she did this thing that she always did in life. She kind of lifted my chin up and she said, oh, Kel, she's going to be so okay. You have no idea. But it's going to be a long journey. Don't leave before the miracle. And then just like that, it was gone. And I was in a room with a bunch of people, and I kind of opened my eyes and looked around like, whoa, whoa. And I swore I would never tell a living soul. But obviously I have. And I share that because that day, I could breathe. From that day forward, Charlotte was still having seizures at that time. I could breathe a little bit better. I could breathe a little bit better. If you are new and you are here today, and I'm sharing things that you're thinking, that's crazy talk. Forget about it. This is my story. This is what's happened in my life. Take what you like and leave the rest. But I have learned not to leave before the miracle. Today I know that my children have a higher power, their own higher power. I have my higher power who's looking out for me. My oldest daughter has hers, my second daughter, and my little son has his too. And this is a new journey for me. I have realized that I tend to want to control everything in my children's lives because I want to keep them safe, and I can already see the problem this is creating. So I am now listening again, once again in my meetings, and listening to the moms and the dads share about their journeys with their teenagers and their preteens, and taking note and filing that away. But my solutions... When I got here, I didn't have a sponsor for a long time. I didn't have a sponsor because I thought, I'm smart. I could read the literature. I could do this. I get it. And I did that for a long time. And what I found was I was doing 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, step 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, over and over again. And when skipping back to when I met my husband, I knew that I needed to be accountable to another woman and share with her how frightened I was. And that's when I ran to a sponsor. And that's when my program really kicked up a notch. And I asked a woman to be my sponsor who how to sponsor herself. She went to meetings on a regular basis, at least 2 meetings a week, and she worked the steps and she worked the traditions. And when she would share, she was always real. She would always share this wisdom and this solution, but then she would always share how she messed it up today with her husband, with her kids, and then she'd share the solution. And there was a sense of humor that she had about being human. And there was a deep spirituality that she had, and that's what I wanted. And so when I asked her to be my sponsor, that's when the game stopped of when somebody would ask me, how are you doing? And I'd say, fine, right? And then I'd still continue to feel all alone. First time I called her, she was a fast talker. She's a fast talker. And I called her, and she said, hi, how are you doing? Am I going to see you at the meeting tonight? And I said, yeah. And she said, great, all right, see you then. And she hung up. And I thought, oh, no. And so I got out a piece of paper, and I wrote down everything I was feeling. And my fingers dialed her number again, and she answered the phone. And she said, hi, what's up? And I said, can I just read to you what I wrote? And she says, yeah, sure. And I read to her how not fine I was. And she said, oh, I see. And we talked, and we talked. And my solution for, like, the first 3 years of my relationship with my sponsor was take contrary action and let it begin with me. And I swear, that is still, those two are still the big doers for me in my life. Take contrary action, because I was terrified. I'm telling you, I was one of those people who would get to a meeting 5 minutes late so I didn't have to hug anybody, so I didn't have to stand around not knowing what to do, right? Because I didn't know, am I supposed to do chairs? I don't know how to do chairs. I don't know how to do the ashtrays. People smoked in meetings back then. I didn't know how to do these things, right? And I would also watch the clock, and 5 minutes before the end of the meeting, I would leave for the same reason. I don't know how to stand by myself. I don't know how to go talk to people. And so she would tell me, and I told her that. I would call her and say, I have a confession to make. And that was always our phone calls. I have a confession to make. Because I had been keeping everything a secret for so long. Keeping everything a secret. I needed you to know that I knew what I was doing. And so with her, I could say, I don't have a flipping clue on how to go to a meeting. I don't know how to stand around. I'm so uncomfortable in my own skin. Can you help me? Can I just attach myself to you? And in the beginning, she said, yes, you can. I'll save a seat for you. Oh, God, that was so important to me. I'd get to that meeting. She'd have her purse, and I'd think, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And I'd sit down. And then at break, she'd say, go hug 5 people. And I'd go, And I would. And I'm still kind of, sometimes I still interrupt people. I still don't do it well. I still interrupt people and walk away when in the middle they're talking to me. And, you know, I'm still clunky and clumsy. And I, you know, I've been in this program 20-something years, and I still walk away going, oh, geez, what did I just say to that person? They didn't realize I was being funny. Oh, gosh, right? I mean, I'm human. It's the same thing. And I would call her because I was starting a new career, because I wanted, my whole life, I loved literature, and I loved the stage, and I wanted to be an actress. But the problem with that was I was the shyest person in the world, and I was the most insecure person in the world. And so I took these acting classes, and I had these people who believed in my talent, but then when I would get up on stage, I would just freeze, right? I would just freeze. And so when my husband and I got married, I was going to follow acting for a little while, and I decided, no, I'm going to run from that, and I didn't know what to do with myself, and so my husband made a suggestion. He said, why don't you become a teacher? And I said, that's the last thing I want to do. I do not want to become a teacher. But it was the most practical thing to do, and what my sponsor had been working on me with was stop running away from the doors that you're in and shoving open new doors. Stop doing that. Because what she pointed out is that anytime anything got uncomfortable, and everything did, because everything is a journey of self-improvement, right? That's why we're here. So everything inevitably gets uncomfortable. Everything good gets uncomfortable. Not that that's bad. It's just you're getting transformed into the beautiful thing that your higher power wants you to be. So anytime anything got to that sticking point where it got uncomfortable, I was like, well, I'm done with that. I think I want to be this instead. I'm done with that relationship. hey, that guy looks good over there. I mean, I would just run from one thing to the next. And so she worked with me on stop running, stop shoving open those doors. So when my husband made this suggestion, she says, well, what's your degree in? And I told her. And she says, well, where would you need to go to school? Well, right across the street. She's like, well, it seems to me that that's the door that's open. Okay, fine. And so I went through that door, and I tried to run away. There was one day in particular in my career that I couldn't do it. It's like I had a relapse into being so shy that, you know, I heard a long time ago when I was a teenager, I heard this AA share. Gosh, I wish I knew who. It was a long time ago, but he talked about the vulture on the headboard. I don't know if that rings a bell for anybody, but he would say that he would wake up in the morning and there was a vulture on that headboard, and that vulture would say, oh, I'm so glad you're awake. I'm so glad you're awake. You know that thing that's on your leg? It's cancer. You know, when you go to work today, they're going to find out you don't know what you're doing. You're going to get fired. And man, when he shared that, I thought, you are so my people. That is exactly what I suffer from. And so on this particular day in my career, I couldn't do it. I woke up that morning and I just couldn't do it. I was too afraid. I was horrible at this adventure. And so I called my master teacher and said, I quit. I can't do this. And she says, what's going on? And I said, it's too hard. It's not worth it. I never see my husband anymore. I'm sick all the time. The kids don't appreciate blah, blah. And she says, all of that is true. Take the day off, go to Starbucks, write some poetry, do whatever, and then I'll see you tomorrow. Now, see, this woman, my master teacher, she was like my sponsor in Al-Anon. She was one of those tough ladies. Now I realize that my higher power knew I needed a sponsor in my meetings and I needed a sponsor in my new adventure. She's not in program, but boy, God was speaking through her. And so I wanted to say it to her. What I really wanted to say to her was, get out of here. I'm an adult. I don't have to come back. I quit, and you can't keep me from it. But I was terrified of her. I wanted to impress her, and I said, okay, fine. So I showed up the next day. And when I showed up, she locked the door of her classroom, and she looked at me, and she said, this is the hardest thing you'll ever do in your life. And she went on this rampage. This is true, this is true, this is true. And she said, you used to play sports. Didn't you have a coach who pushed you so hard and you hated his guts the whole time and you complained about it? But at the end of the season, when you achieved this, that, and the other, you looked at that coach and said, wow, we did it. If it weren't for you, I would have never gotten there. And I said, no, I never had that coach because I always quit. And she said, now I understand my role. And she said, listen, you don't have to become a teacher. She said, I think you'd be a fool not to, because I think you're born to do this. But it's your choice. You don't have to become a teacher, but you're going to finish what you started. And this was the same thing my sponsor was saying to me. You're going to finish what you started. You're going to show up every day. And then when you get your credential, if you decide not to do this, fine. Gosh, I thought, it's so unfair. But I did. She set my parameters. And so every day I would show up. And it was hard, but I would. But see what she did for me? It became a one day at a time thing. One day at a time, I'm going to do this. One day at a time. And I've had my career for 14 years. And the ironic thing is that you can't kick me out the door now. I love what I'm doing. My sponsor said to me, I struggled. I didn't struggle with the first step. By the time I got a sponsor, that first step was in stone. I knew that my life had become unmanageable because I had been through Alateen. I had been through relationships. I was now in a relationship with a normal guy, and things were still, I was still unhappy. So I knew it was me. I couldn't point the finger at any situation anymore. So I came in with that first step pretty well done. I struggled with the second step, which was humbling for me because I had a faith. I really did. But what I realized my struggle was that I didn't believe that he gave a flying flip about me. I didn't believe I was worthy enough. Because if I was worthy enough, he wouldn't have let certain things happen. If I was worthy enough, he would have intervened at this point. If he cared enough, then this. If he cared enough. When I came into this program, nobody was ever enough. You weren't enough. My higher power wasn't enough. I wasn't enough, and I was doomed to a life of unhappiness and loneliness because it was never enough. Second step came to believe. My sponsor told me to take a 30-minute walk every day and to start looking for the ways that my higher power was present in my day. And she said, when you start doing this, you're going to have things come back to you from earlier in your life and go with it. Your higher power is going to reveal when he was in your life prior to now. I still do this. I still try to take a walk for a half an hour or even 15 minutes every day. And I am telling you, when I first started, I would see one or two ways that my higher power was in my day. And now, the reason why I go for a half an hour and sometimes for an hour is because it just keeps coming. It just keeps coming, right? Oh, I got to wake up today. Oh, nobody cut me off today. Or I have all my arms today. I have all my legs today. And it's like my brain doesn't stop with all the ways my higher power is just giving me one gift after another. I get to be a mom today. You know, before Al-Anon, I was looking at all the ways he wasn't in my life. And I could do that now if I wanted to. My recovery hinges on my perspective. It hinges on my attitude. And so today, I choose happiness. When I first heard that in these rooms, I hated that phrase. Gosh, did I hate that phrase. Right? Choose happiness. Choose happiness. Yeah, right, if it was only that easy. And now, it is. It is that easy. In the midst of seizures. In the midst of losing my mom. It doesn't mean I'm not going to feel pain. It doesn't mean that I'm not going to maybe be disappointed that people aren't doing things my way. But I can feel those things and walk through those things, holding your hand, surrendering them to my higher power on a daily basis. And as soon as I surrender, I get to look at where my feet are, and my feet are on that trail outside in the sunshine. And now I hear the birds chirping, and man, God placed that bird right there for me. What a beautiful song, right? And it's like, my brain, all of a sudden, is connected to the source of joy. Trudging the happy road of destiny. I don't have to be alone anymore. When I am thinking about all the ways that you're not enough and he's not enough and my higher power is enough, I have isolated myself from the joy. Because I'm too afraid. And when I allow myself to look for the good, I connect. I connect to you. I connect my higher power to your higher power. There's nothing that stops me from that ever-flowing source of joy but myself. And going through the crises in the last couple of years have proven that, right? I love that part in our literature that talks about no unhappiness. Now I'm going to mess it up. Is too great to be lessened. Is that right? Right? I love that. It's a promise. If you listen to the readings in the meeting, we have promises in our literature. And every time I hear one, I go, and I just grab onto it and I hold onto it. I used to sit in my meeting and I would close my eyes to that closing. And on a few occasions, because I would really just meditate on that because I wanted to take that phrase with me. And on this one occasion, this woman came up to me and said, are you okay? Your eyes were closed. And I said, I am just holding on to that piece of literature for dear life. It's my life preserver. My sponsor also gave me a bracelet with one word on it. It said trust. And she gave me a visual for when nothing could get through here. And it jingles. She's so smart, that sponsor. I swear there's a sponsor school that she went through, right? I see it, it jingles, I hear it. And so every day I would practice trust. Turn it over and trust. Go on your walk. Kelly, look for ways that I have painted the day with love just for you. Just for you. And what I said to my sponsor with this second and third step was, show me in the literature where it says that my higher power wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. Because I cannot turn my life and my will over to just a power. I need to know that that power wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. And she said, I know it's in there. I can't remember. Let me talk to a few people. And like within 5 minutes, she was back at me. Here it is. Oh, yes. Because I swear there's something magical about the literature. If it's in the literature, I feel like it's a promise. So I know my higher power wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. And your higher power wants you to be happy, joyous, and free. And so then began the step through the shame. The steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Oh my gosh, what a gift that process has been. What an absolute gift. Because now looking back, what I can see is the whole time I was doing 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, it's kind of like I was putting this veneer of recovery over all this muck, right? And I could go on that recovery, but I wasn't going through. There were more miracles that my higher power had in store for me and has in store for all of us. I really believe that these steps are miraculous for me, because I got to go back. My sponsor said, when you do your fourth step, I want you to pray. I want you to pray that God will bring up everything that's supposed to be brought up. And if you feel it, write it. If you feel it, write it. Take your higher power with you. Okay, that's what I did. So I'd pray. And she'd say, don't stop your pen until you feel like he's done talking. Oh, it was exhausting writing that fourth step, because he took me back through. I found myself writing things like, when I was in elementary school, nobody would play with me on the playground. And I'd think, and right away I'd be the Al-Anon. I'd judge myself for it, right? I'd write that down and say, that's stupid. That's not good enough to go on a fourth step. I mean, just the not good enough, right? But she told me, write it down. So I'd write it down. And so I found myself writing all kinds of things. And what I got to see is that all of these resentments that I had, and so many of them I wouldn't have called resentments. They were just things I was holding on to. I wasn't angry about them, but they were in there, right? And so when I wrote this fourth step, there were all of these things that were coming up. And when I went to her house for my fifth step, I sat with her and I shared with her, and she smiled, and God bless her. She listened to the whole darn thing. I mean, it went on and on and on. And she listened to the whole thing, and she'd say, oh, me too. Oh, me too. Oh, me too. And so here was the spiritual guru in front of me who was saying that she did these things too. And then this monarch butterfly flew through her garden, and she said, I've never seen that monarch butterfly here before. And she said, your higher power just sent you a gift. Did you see that? No, but I see it now. And now every time I see a monarch butterfly, I say, thank you, God, for sending me that monarch butterfly. I mean, really, the gifts around me all the time are there for the taking. And I feel the love. I feel the love. When I don't feel the love, then I know that I am isolating myself. And that's how this disease affected me. Because, you know, for the drinkers in my life, and there are still some drinkers in my life, I don't know who all of them are, and that's progress, but, you know, when they feel they drink, and for me, when I feel I think, and I think hard, and I put everything aside to think, and as soon as I start thinking, that is going to take me on the path to isolating, because I don't have time to participate. I don't have time to play around. I don't have time to go to the party. I don't have time to go to the convention because I have some serious thinking to do. And then slowly but surely, all of my miracles start to dissolve, and they all start to crumble. And so what my sponsor taught me was take contrary action. That's what I was saying before. Just put it down. Just stop thinking. Who cares? It'll work itself out. It'll work itself out. Just get there. Just go. Just get there. Just go. You know, if a friend calls me from the program and says, you want to do this? Yes. Always what's happening inside is, no, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do that. But I've been trained well by you. Just say yes. And then when I go, the discomfort lasts for 20 seconds. And then I'm smiling and I'm having an adventure. Today, my life is such a wonderful adventure. I'm surrounded by teenagers all the time, and I get to participate in their life, and they get to participate in mine. I'm surrounded by Al-Anons all the time. I'm surrounded by recovery. I get to watch your miracles. You know, my family used to speak together. And I was sharing this with somebody. My mom, my dad, my brother, and I used to speak in LA County. We've lived the journey of one person going into program, then all of us, then family recovery, then speaking together around California. And then that changed when my mom passed away and I moved to Orange County. My dad moved to Orange County. My brother lives somewhere else. And all of a sudden, it came to my heart one day, and I prayed, God, I miss my mom, and I really miss those miracles that come with being able to give back what was so freely given to me in this program. I miss those miracles. And it was like a week after that, that somebody called me and asked me to speak at a meeting. And the journey evolved and it began again. And today I get to be with you and share my story. And when I started, I didn't think it was going to go this way. I didn't think I was going to lose my mom at such a young age. I didn't think that we were all going to separate. I didn't think this, I didn't think that. But you've taught me to not leave before the miracle. And I'm so glad that during that time where I had to walk away because being in a meeting was more painful, I'm glad that my higher power kept a seat for me. I'm glad that you kept a seat for me. See, I thought when I walked away that that was it, that I was done with Al-Anon, that the miracles were over for me. I got my miracles with my family, and now it was somebody else's turn. And now I realize it doesn't work that way. As long as we're here, our miracles continue forever. I am not walking away from this again. There's so much joy. There's so much connection. I am living a life today beyond my wildest dreams. I'm married to my best friend. And when my daughter started to have her seizures, I remember sitting next to him in the hospital. And I stayed in the hospital with her that night, and he went home to take care of our other daughter. When he came the next day to relieve me, the nurse at Chalk said, "I'll stay with your daughter. Why don't you guys walk together to your car? That way you guys can have a moment alone together." What a gift that nurse gave us. And we said, okay. So we went down the elevator. And now, as we hit the doors of that hospital, I have this moment where I thought to myself, oh, I'm going out. I can see the sunshine. I'm about to walk into the sunshine. The last time I was in that sunshine was when I didn't know that my life was going to come crashing down. And now I'm about to walk back out into that world with this reality now. And we walked outside, and we're quiet, and we're holding hands, and I'm reading. There are these bricks that are down on the ground where these kids have painted these beautiful bricks. And I'm reading them, and there's all this joy around me. I can hear the birds, and I can hear the sun, but of course I'm devastated. And I look up at my husband, and I say, "Did you ever think, when you proposed to me, that we would end up going through something like this?" And I'm crying. And he said, "No. Are you ready?" And his just lighthearted, "No, I didn't. But are you ready? Let's do this. Let's crush it. Let's do it," was so healing to me. That's the man I married. Al-Anon has been the same way. I had no idea when I went home to my mom that day and said, "I almost took my life today." And she said, "You're going to go to Alatine." And I thought it was like a life sentence of just awfulness. I had no idea what miracles were in store for me. My entire life today, I owe in gratitude to everybody who has walked in Al-Anon before me, to everybody who's walked in AA before me, everybody who's walked in Alatine before me. This is a family disease, and it is a family recovery. And I love these conventions where we celebrate the AAs, the Al-Anons, and the Alatines together. It makes me incredibly happy. Alatine is incredibly important to me. In a place that I traveled to not so recently, there was very little Alatine. And I was talking to somebody, and they were saying their meetings were dwindling. And I was saying, how can we get it going? How can we get Alatine going a little bit more? Because I have to tell you that if I didn't have a place to go when I was 14 years old, it very possibly could be that I'd be in the other rooms today. Because I didn't have any coping mechanisms. But because my mother forced me to go to Alatine, I learned the 12 steps and the 12 traditions at a very young age. If you're new and you're not feeling any miracles and you're not feeling any connection and you're feeling uncomfortable, you're right where you're supposed to be. Don't leave. We got your back. You might be uncomfortable. We're going to hug you. We're going to smile at you. We're going to ask you how you are. And you could say whatever you want. You could say you're fine, or you could say I'm not fine, blah, here it all is. And we're going to love you through it. I read something when I was a teenager that is still the most powerful thing to me. And it was by a poet named Rilke. And he said, how are we able to forget those ancient myths that are about dragons that at the last minute turn into princesses? Perhaps all the dragons of our lives are princesses who are waiting to see us once beautiful and brave. So you must not be saddened if a restlessness like light and cloud shadows passes over your hands and over all you do. You must think that something is happening with you, that life has not forgotten you. It holds you in the palm of its hands. It will not let you fall. I want you to enjoy this weekend. Welcome to the party. Hug and love each other. And if you see me in the halls, please give me a hug and I'll hug you back. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.